Welcome to the Culture File webinar, formerly the Culture File debate, but COVID has demanded that we rethink all aspects of our life, not least of all music. Musicians have been experimenting bravely with new technologies to help them practice and share their art, and lucky for them. But our guests for this month's debate don't actually have that option. Conductors make music, but they don't make sound. So how can they live in this new world, a world in which their special skill of bringing people together is, at least temporarily, out of place? Gathered apart this time, we have four people who've been dealing with exactly these issues over the past few months, and they're going to help us understand the role of the conductor, where it's come from and where it's going. Joining us for this dig are Joanna Caniero. Joanna was formerly musical director at Berklee Symphony Orchestra for nearly a decade, during which she oversaw 14 world premieres. Last season, she conducted the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra at the Edinburgh Festival. Hi, Joanna.
Hello.
Hello. Peter Holman. Peter is Emeritus Professor of Historical Musicology at Leeds University and the author of Before the Baton, which looks at the prehistory of the conductor. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
And from Ireland, we have Róisín Blunney of DCU, who teaches conducting as well as choral studies at Dublin City University and directs several choral ensembles. Hi, Róisín.
Hello, Luke.
And finally, joining us in gallery view is Paul Brough, conductor and professor at the Royal Academy of Music, a regular guest conductor with, among others, the BBC Singers, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the Ulster Orchestra and the Britten Symphonia. In April this year, he became director of music at Keble College in Oxford. So new music appointments are still happening then.
Hi. Yes, they are. And I suppose my own situation was completely COVIDized because I interviewed for the job in March and got the job in March. And in between March and the start date, of course, all this came. So I hadn't actually been there yet. The last time I was there was for when the interview. So I've been doing the job since the 20th of April from my little laptop in Surrey. Interesting. Running a new ensemble remotely for 3 months and getting to know everybody in it and not having actually done anything apart from a couple of little online streams is a learning curve. Let's just put it like that.
There could be a lot more of exactly that sort of thing in all our futures. Just to get a quick idea of where exactly we are, we can see from Paul there that, you know, life could go on. But maybe just to see exactly where we are, we'll ask everyone to get started. When was the last time you were at rehearsals and what was it on? If we start with Joanna.
Well, I was at rehearsal just this morning, and this is the first week I have been conducting since March. My last concert before we all went into confinement was in Scotland. I was conducting the final performance of Nixon in China with Scottish Opera. So I was commenting with some of my colleagues that I'm sure we will all remember the last concert we did before COVID times, because, you know, life was never the same. And it makes us very, very grateful for all those precious moments that we, you know, built all these stories, the operas with the singers, in a way that it will take a long time to come back again. And this morning, I was rehearsing in Lisbon. I started rehearsing 2 days ago at the Gulbenkian Orchestra. And it's the first concert the orchestra is doing with some audience members, about a third of capacity of the auditorium. It's very different. And it's in a way, a feeling of learning again how to play together. Because now we are so separate that it really changes the way we have to think about music. So some musicians are so far away from each other. We are encouraged to not speak so much at rehearsals, especially in certain directions. So it's, again, learning to play together pieces that we've played many, many times. I've played one of the pieces in the concert, which is the Rococo Variations by Tchaikovsky, with this particular orchestra at least 5 or 6 times with different soloists. And we were saying, I don't think we have rehearsed this piece so much in the past. And it's just because the physicality of playing is so different from before. It's much more difficult to play together in a way in the same auditorium that we've played for 20, 30 years. So, you know, we're starting again in a way. We're learning again how to play together physically. But I think the overwhelming feeling is to be very, very grateful and a sense of relief to be sharing music again. And I think particularly for conductors, as you said, we don't really produce sound. And if before COVID times, we had to be very humble about what we did, at the same time that we have to be confident about our work now, I think this really humbles us and it makes us really, really feel that we depend so much on the other one, on everyone else to express who we are as people, as artists. So it's a very humbling and a very grateful experience to come back.
So I love that idea about conductors being asked not to talk too much. It could be a new impediment.
I have to say that was received with great joy by the orchestra. I think that should be a nice piece of advice for any time that we don't speak that much.
Roisin.
The last time I was at rehearsal, Luke, was on the 10th of March, and it was with my chamber choir in here in Dublin, a Le Tare vocal ensemble. And we were rehearsing at that stage for two really exciting events that we were looking forward to. So we were doing a lot of new repertoire at a sort of a very high artistic level for us. So we were reaching for the stars and all in great form. But at the same time, there was just a little sense that something was afoot in Ireland and that things might get quite serious. So it was kind of a mixed feeling rehearsal. We have a number of doctors in the choir and they did look particularly grey in the face on that occasion, and just small undercurrents of worry. But everything changed just 2 days later, actually, when the government announced serious changes to the way we live our lives. But it was certainly a very, very different time, and amazing how quickly everything changed then immediately afterwards.
Paul, what do you remember of your last rehearsal of the old world?
My last music was on the 12th of March. It was a mass setting by Rheinberger, the Cantus Missi, 8-part, when I was looking after Keys Choir in Cambridge for 2 terms. And obviously, that's it. Double bar line.
As of this Friday afternoon in early July in 2020, that's where conductors are at. But what I wanted to do was get some idea of the figure of the conductor in the world before it changed. And for that, we have Peter Holman here, who's written a book looking at the kind of what you might call the prehistory of the conductor. Maybe you'd tell us, Peter, a little bit about how the figure of the conductor emerges, kind of separates itself from the primordial mess of the players and becomes somebody separate.
Well, I suppose the first thing is that conductors originally, I think, were just part of the ensemble, a singer raising a hand, that sort of perhaps a lutenist waggling the neck of his lute. I think that people started standing outside the ensemble, i.e. not actually singing or playing themselves, but just waving their arms around in the middle of the 16th century, when people started writing very large scale music, particularly music for divided choirs, which might be all over the church and therefore needed some sort of coordination. But I should emphasize that sort of conducting was not modern conducting. It was done usually with a roll of paper, certainly in the 17th century, with a roll of paper, just up down movements, no sideways. There were no subdivision of beats, and the idea was just to keep good ensemble, not to try to influence the performance, even to give entries. There's evidence in the 18th century that people didn't even give entries. The members of choirs or orchestras had to be responsible for that themselves. Then I think in the 18th century, what tended to happen, it was different types of music were directed in different ways. So choral music, the roll of paper, up, down. Opera, very much directed from the harpsichord. A bit later on in the late 18th century, from the violin. But then there was a move back to the piano in the early 19th century. Composers like Rossini and Weber, who directed, they weren't modern conductors, they directed from the piano. It's not until the 1830s, certainly in Britain, and also in Italy even later, that modern style conducting comes up. I was very surprised to see, for instance, a picture of Donizetti, not with a modern baton, but holding a roll of paper.
As conductors, I wonder how much of the development of the figure of the conductor you kind of recognise and how you envisage yourself in that continuum. Paul?
Well, of course, I know that all of us stand outside the ensemble, but really our role is an extra pair of ears. Everybody knows that you can't really listen to something if you're doing something important at the same time, because your ears have to be ready to listen. And I know that that's the challenge for all of us, that as we wave our hands, we have to keep our ears open at the same time. And that, of course, ties in with the historical view that Peter was giving of the conductor. As the ensemble gets bigger, the more necessary it is to have an independent listener to make sure that it's working properly. Yeah,
but actually, even in the 18th century, very large ensembles were frequently directed from the keyboard.
Yeah.
Good example being the Handel commemorations in the 1780s and 90s, where up to 1,000 people were directed from the organ.
I wonder if it was any good.
Oh, I'm sure it was. Well, everyone said it was at the time. And I think there's a terrible tendency for us to look back at the history of conducting and assuming everything was total chaos until the modern baton came along. In fact, one of the main themes of my book is to try to disprove that and say that actually it's horses for courses.
Well, I think everybody who's been listening to Culture File over the last two nights will know exactly what's going on in your book. Joanna, how does that strike you?
Well, I think that debate has happened also inside my mind the past 20 years that I've been conducting, because I stand between many opinions. I have to say, I don't conduct certain repertoire now that I used to conduct because I don't think I'm needed. For example, I used to conduct the Brandenburg concertos. I don't do that anymore. I think with a great leader from the continuum, I don't think the orchestra necessarily needs a conductor. And in fact, in the orchestras that I've been music director of, including right now the Portuguese National Symphony, I encourage very much that we have a series of chamber orchestra concerts in which I try as much as I can to not have a conductor, because that develops skills of the orchestra that otherwise it's more difficult to develop a certain sense of independence and responsibility in the musicians. It's against myself and my profession that I do this, but I do find that there are certain, I come from instrumental music mostly from that point of view. So we play a lot of Mozart without conductor. And I think that the key for that to be successful is to have enough rehearsal time. And Peter knows this so much better and could explain this in a much, much better way. The way I feel about repertoire that I conduct, I think that the development of history of music has made music not only, it's not so much for me the size, but the complexity, the rhythmical complexity, the layers of instruments playing, the counterpoint, it has become quite complex with time, that in the amount of time that we have to prepare, I really think that we need an independent musician to lead. And I see the figure of the conductor emerging from that necessity of the complexity of music and the way that we must rehearse. A rehearsal cannot be a democratic event. Unless we had 1,000 rehearsals for each concert, it cannot be a democratic event in which all 100 opinions can be listened to and reflected on, and then someone makes a decision. So that's just not practical. We must have an independent pair of ears that knows every part and has had time to really think about the overall picture and how each instrument is, you know, communicating with the other one to help and prepare this maybe naturally not so homogenous sound into a homogenous sound.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that the difference in the 18th century, of course, is the conductor, as it were, the director, was usually the composer himself. And therefore he had that authority. But the difference was that he exercised the authority in rehearsal rather than in performance. So that Handel directing an oratorio would have played. He preferred to play because he felt he could influence the performance more radically, but through his superb playing than waving his arms around.
Well, I suppose in the end, what we're all arriving at is the fact that if you've got an ensemble of singers and players, or a combination of both, that is being rehearsed by one person, by the end of the rehearsal process, they should have made themselves redundant. And then what can they bring to the performance that can be added in on the top of having made themselves redundant?
Well, there, I think there's a difference there between modern music making and 18th century music making. I think that it would have seemed very strange to Bach and Handel to the idea of actually adding something in performance. That's what modern conducting technique does, isn't it?
It's a pity there. I thought Joanna was going to leave us in a world where we didn't need the conductor at all, which was fine because we're... No.
Oh, I don't think so, because can you imagine? Let's just take a piece like The Rite of Spring. It's impossible to play without the conductor. It's just... I cannot even imagine how that could happen. Even in a performance, it's simply not possible to play together without an independent figure leading. It's just impossible.
Having said that, it's much easier to play The Rite of Spring without a conductor than it is to play The Rite of Spring with a bad conductor.
That's also very true. That's also very, very, very true.
There are some choirs that do very well without conductors, but they tend to be the exception. You know, like, for example, Anuna from Ireland should be very kind of global ambassadors for Irish music in a way, have this sort of collective intuition that's very carefully cultivated over time and does work very well for them. But I think the norm would be that the conductor is the pilot flying the plane, in a sense.
Well, Roisin, you're involved in training conductors. What are the kind of personalities that favour that? What draws people into conducting at an undergraduate level?
It's actually a really exciting time to be involved in the training of conductors in Ireland, because the choral scene is so very vibrant at the moment, and we've got a lot of conductors.
Well, not right this minute, I guess.
Absolutely. Sometimes, honest to God, I keep forgetting the pandemic is there, and then it just hits like a bolt of lightning. But in these times, I suppose, in these recent years, there are a lot of conductors who are, you know, benefiting from training opportunities that weren't available until very recently. And on the MA in Choral Studies now in DCU, we get people coming from a wide range of backgrounds, just to kind of go from where they are to where they want to be as conductors. And what we do on that programme is that all the students form a very nice choral ensemble, and then they sort of take turns rehearsing and conducting that ensemble. So you get, you know, very quiet people who may be very intuitive, great listeners, a great calmness in their approach. And then you'd have people who may be more confident, more experienced in standing in front of groups, better with their public speaking, but you know, you get all sorts of people coming from kind of workplace choir backgrounds, student choir backgrounds, all sorts of different backgrounds. You know, we try to encourage a really high level of listening to the ensemble, listening to what you're actually hearing, and giving, you know, predicting problems and having solutions ready to go, to be able to demonstrate vocally the ideal way for performing a phrase, and being able to perform everything yourself, being able to give a confident demonstration of anything that you want the choir to do. So I suppose earning the right musically to stand in front of your choir and be that expert is something that we really try to encourage in our students.
But of course, knowing the right thing to do has just entered a whole new phase, in that the conductor has always had a kind of collegial responsibility for his musicians and her musicians notably. But now there is going to be a very specific kind of requirement on a conductor, which is working within the new framework of COVID, which I'd like to talk a little bit about now. One of the things that's happened so far is we've seen, I think it was Simon Rattle, conducted a small version of the Berliner Philharmonic, a tiny version, because there are actually technical limitations on how many people you can eyeball if they're all socially distant. Now, that seems like such an extra musical problem, and yet that is definitely something that the conductor will have to deal with. Peter?
Well, I mean, I suppose as an early music specialist, I'm in a way, we're in a slightly fortunate position, since we're mostly dealing with small ensembles anyway. And I think that they're planning to have small orchestras in this small version of the Proms. And I think it's where there's going to be a lot of 18th century music going on, or early 19th century music with small orchestras, which is great, because I think quite often in the Proms one hears very overblown performances designed for the Albert Hall, of music originally written for much smaller ensembles. I remember quite a memorable but a very overblown St John Passion, for instance, in the Albert Hall a few years ago.
So, Paul, is this a wonderful development to take the pomp out of pomp and circumstance?
Well, that may be so. I mean, for my own situation, post-COVID, nobody really knows yet what post-COVID is going to be, and let's not get onto the new normal or anything like that. But my job is going to be like starting my college choir as if it's never existed. You know, whenever we repopulate, and we don't know when that is, it's going to be like we decided last week we're going to have a choir. and it's going to be re-education, reformation, recreation. Everything's going to have an RE on the front. And that's going to do us more good than harm, actually. It's just possible that I know that all of us have stood in front of an ensemble and thought, well, if I had this lot from scratch, I'd do this, this and this. Well, now's our chance.
That is a very interesting question, whether this will actually shape the repertoire in new ways. I mean, you could be extreme, Joanna. Will this kill the symphony? The great super spreader event of the 19th century symphony is that no more?
Well, I think that's a very important question. And I think more than finding pieces, to me, it's not so much the repertoire that worries me. To me is the fact that, for example, my orchestra, we have more than 90 musicians and we have to make sure that they are all working. This is very important. So there's a human side of this that is extremely important. We can adjust to any repertoire, but it's really important that the musicians keep playing together. So what we are trying to do is to divide the ensembles we have in two, sometimes in three, and make sure that we're all playing. I think that for a time we will have to adjust in terms of repertoire. Like New Zealand, they are already performing full symphonies with a full audience because they have no cases. But I think we're a little bit far from that reality. But fortunately, if we want to play some of the 19th century and early 20th century big symphonies, there are versions that were written for smaller orchestras. And this is a way that we can keep the symphonic feeling going. I'm doing Fawn, the Schoenberg version. This week, Prélude à l'après-midi d'enfant, I'm doing the Schoenberg version, for example, which is for a smaller ensemble. We can do some Tchaikovsky. I'm doing Mozartiana this week. So I think we just have to adjust because repertoire exists.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those creative solutions, like what is happening and what information is coming down to you about what we're going to need. Joanna, you've got something in rehearsal. So what kind of conversations did you have prior to getting that project moving? How were the regulations handed to you and how did you try and adapt them and work with them?
First of all, how many musicians can we fit in said stage? So that was the first parameter. So we could fit between 35 and 40 with the 2 meters for strings and 4 meters between woodwind players and brass players. So that was the first consideration. Then we have some acrylic pieces between the woodwinds and the brass and the strings. So there's extra protection. Then the issue of wearing masks or not wearing masks. Of course, the wind players will not wear masks. String players are encouraged to wear masks, even though it's not necessary. But if they don't wear a mask, something so simple, they have to discard their mask before going on stage to rehearsal because a mask cannot be put down on a piece of furniture, for example. And they have to disinfect their hands before going on stage after throwing the mask away. In 2 weeks' time, I'm rehearsing my own orchestra because if it's a bigger space, we can do a 3-hour rehearsal with one break. And I can do 4 rehearsals, so I can rehearse a longer program. So I think it will depend on each orchestra, the space we are playing in, and the regulations that the musicians themselves agree on. I usually think of myself as a quite efficient person in rehearsal. And today I found myself struggling with the time because we're so far away. You know, this intimacy that happens when you perform together, an orchestra is just an extension of chamber music feeling. And now I'm just so far away from the closest musician to me that it's a very strange feeling. And that creates problems that we didn't have before. So I think efficiency now, as you're saying, will be even more important. And with pieces that we know very well, not necessarily new pieces or pieces that might not be that complicated at first sight.
Paul mentioned there the idea of people reinventing themselves for the new circumstances, but some groups that are doing that very well are the likes of the choir I Fagiolini and Voce's 8, who have been producing these absolutely fantastic kind of choral education videos over the period of lockdown, and really, you know, bringing expert's knowledge to a very broad audience through engaging with, for example, the madrigals of Monteverdi with some excellent introductory musicological context from the conductor Robert Hollingworth, and then singers can sing along with the score and the screen and things like that. So in a less than ideal world for music making, some groups really are very sort of generous and expert in sharing their knowledge with a very broad audience.
We touched on it a little bit there. Roisin was talking about great developments that have happened that sort of have leveraged technology in kind of useful ways. I mean, I'm surprised this gathering today actually has been quite positive about what's happening. You know, that's presumably the only way to survive. But I just wonder if you've come across other technological kind of approaches or solutions that you might find useful. I mean, gathering an orchestra not in the same place is a redundant activity, or is it?
And I think the conversation has been very much about that, especially among composers and conductors who conduct a lot of contemporary music, in that I think composers will of our time not only will help us reflect on who we are now, as they always did through times, but I think they will be able to help include a larger number of musicians in a performance through technology. I remember in the beginning of COVID times of confinement, a great conductor saying something like, I'm commissioning a new opera. And of course, we cannot have a lot of singers on stage. So we have decided to pre-record some of the choral parts to be part of the performance. And of course, now the regulations have changed and now we can have more musicians on stage. But I think for me, as positive as I am, the thing that I'm most worried about is opera. How will we be able to perform an opera as we are used to? And of course, opera in concert is wonderful. But if you imagine an opera house, it involves so many art forms and so many artists, lighting, the stage designers, and this crisis will affect a great deal all these great artists and colleagues. And that's the thing that I'm most worried about. And I just hope that we can find a lot of creative ways, also through technology, to help this art form. So that's the thing that I'm most worried about. Everything else, I think it's easier to reinvent with less musicians, maybe more concerts, but less musicians. I think that's possible.
The opera that all opera houses should be planning post-COVID, of course, is King Harold's Saga by Judith Weir, where one solo unaccompanied soprano sings all eight roles.
I wonder, will the audience outnumber the cast in that production, should it be the only opera available? Well, thank you all very much. That's been a very, actually quite a kind of positive and hopeful conversation. I was afraid when we would gather here that perhaps we'd see a grim landscape in front of us. But actually, maybe we're seeing that new forms might emerge, new ways of dealing with problems that aren't necessarily going to destroy the world we know, but make a new one. So thank you all very much, Joanna Caniero, Peter Holman, Roisin Blumy and Paul Brough, for coming to meet us today in these most uncertain of times for music and indeed humanity. If we haven't figured out the future of the latter, at least we have some ideas on what conductors have ahead of them. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.